Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 8-Bit Adventures Podcast. This is episode 249. So, welcome, everybody. I am your host, Sean Hayes. And we've had to kind of scramble together to do some to do some stuff for this week. I will get into that a bit later as to why. I tried to pull some like interesting news for this week. We had CES, but usually CES just ends up being a bunch of like products that will likely never come to pass. So there's some interesting news, our deep dive for this week's episode, actually inspired by a product that I kicked on Backstarter that is coming soon. I got the notice that it actually shipped out after many, many trials and tribulations. So very excited about that. So this is the 8-Bit Adventures Podcast. We're here to bring you the latest and greatest geeky news of the week. So hope you all have been staying happy, staying healthy, and staying safe in these trying times. So why don't we get right into it? Let's get into our news for this week, shall we? All right. So some interesting news to start things off. Square Enix, the makers of Final Fantasy and other franchises, have announced they are now going to enter the non-fungible token foray with, quote, decentralized gaming, whatever that means, and some play-to-contribute design strategies for 2022. Essentially, they're looking at NFTs and looking at NFTs in a way for players basically to, like, one of the strategies they're looking at is, like, as an example, that this is an example, but not like a thing that they specifically said they're going to do. But imagine if while you're not playing Final Fantasy 14, your gear would all be non-fungible tokens, and that you could rent out your gear to other people who want to use it, and then you make money. Or ways in which, like, the tokens, like, allow you to contribute to the game's design or something like that. Ultimately, this is just, once again, cashing in on the NFT fad. I'm going to call it a fad, folks. Because I don't see any of this working. Like, there's been a number of articles that have pointed out, like, it's when working with game assets, like, you can't really transfer them from one game to another unless they're specifically, like, it has to be future-proofed. So, like, if two games, even within the same franchise, use different engines, it's not going to work. So, yeah, who knows? But they're back in this, and they've kind of doubled down on it, and the internet reacted about as usual as we'd expect. And they're not backing down. So, yeah. Shame on you, Square Enix. So, all right, next up. Riot Games. So for once this week, we do not have Activision Blizzard news. Instead, we're going to talk about Riot Games. So League of Legends and Valorant publisher has agreed to a $100 million settlement deal in a discrimination and harassment lawsuit by female employees. So this was a suit that was actually brought in 2018, class action lawsuit, that was previously settled for $10 million. Before, now this is going to sound familiar, the California DFEH and DLSE. So if those don't sound familiar, these are the departments in California that are bringing the lawsuit against Activision Blizzard. They stepped in and said, that's not enough money. This needs to be settled for more money. Like, they deserve more money. And so over the course now of three-ish, we'll call it a three and change-ish years, that number increased by tenfold. So yeah, $100 million settlement. Now, whether that actually makes any meaningful change has yet to be seen. So hopefully it does. And hopefully pressure from the community and from other developers and stuff. And, you know, that if the employees can unionize, because there has been talk of that over at Activision Blizzard. But this is relevant and I suppose tangentially related to that lawsuit, since one of the lead developers over there is Greg Street, who used to be one of the game leads, I think, for World of Warcraft. So, yeah. So there's that. All right. But as I said, no Activision Blizzard news for this week. Still relatively quiet for the time being. So we'll see if that lasts. Next up, here's a piece of fun news. So this is CyberPower PC has unveiled sort of a new machine case. So this is called the Kinetic Case. And this is really weird. And I love weird stuff like this. So this case, for audio listeners, you know, it has a typical CyberPower case where it's glass on the side and it's got the RGB lights inside and everything. But the front is almost like a geodesic surface, right? So if you're not familiar with the concept of a geodesic dome, it's Spaceship Earth and Epcot Center. So this is a series of triangles that are made up of triangles, and the whole front of the computer is made like this. Those are all air vents that can open and close. So like they open and close like little barnacles. It uses temperature sensors inside the case to detect the temperature, and if it gets too hot, opens more and more air vents to improve airflow, and as it cools off, closes them to supposedly reduce noise and dust buildup. This produces like a somewhat organic breathing effect from the machine, or as a barnacle effect where they're like gradually opening and closing. I thought it was really cool and weird and deserved to be mentioned. So, yeah. And I have to say, you know, CyberPower, some people have said, that they don't have great customer service. I have never had a problem with my machine. I have a CyberPower PC. It works fine. Works way better than any other PC I've had. And I've had it for a lot longer than other PCs. So yeah. And in fact, like I haven't had to make any upgrades to it. So also like it's got pretty good staying power. I believe the article said from The Verge said that if the machine proved popular enough, they would have the case available. I guess for like to buy it itself, like on its own for around $250. Now granted, that's just the case. Like that does include all the materials inside it. So it's not getting a computer for $250. This would just be the outer shell. I have to say, not something that I would buy myself, but, I think it's great. And I'm sure there's somebody out there that would want to buy this thing. Please, somebody, if this appeals to you, buy it, because I want to see more weird and funky stuff happen like this. And like whether it actually is useful or not, who knows, right? I don't know if there's any like hard evidence that it would actually reduce dust buildup and reduce noise or not. But you know, we'll see. All right, finally, Spider-Man: No Way Home is Sony's most successful movie ever. Just out of all of them. And it's also the highest grossing pandemic era film with over $1 billion in revenue. which just goes to show Marvel films still an absolute juggernaut and nothing to be sneezed at. And this one, especially with the buildup. So if you haven't listened, if you have seen it and you haven't listened to last week's episode where my buddy Jamal hopped on the podcast and we reviewed it and had a discussion of it, be sure to go check that out. So episode 248 is our spoiler cast. But yeah, totally worth it. It was great. It was great. Comic book superhero film and a great tribute to Spider-Man films in general. So yeah, I totally believable that it would make that much money. I was surprised that it's, Sony's most successful film ever. That seems odd to me, although I feel like, I guess really all the big ones that they have are Spider-Man. So, you know, I don't know what else they have that would be sort of a big blockbuster like that. So yeah, that is going to wrap up our quick fire news. Very quick this week, you know, just a lot of it was, so-and-so released a new laptop or so-and-so is releasing a new graphics card or things like that. And it's like, that's not really exciting news. So, you know, I mean, for something like that, it would be like when the Steam Deck finally comes out, like that'll be a piece of news. But you know, if it's just like, oh, there's a new laptop, it's like, oh, there's a new laptop like every week. So that's not new and exciting. So that is going to wrap up our gaming news for the week. So we can get into our deep dive on, iterative updates and refreshes and additions, for games in general. So I thought about this topic because my copy of Sentinels of the Multiverse Definitive Edition will be arriving at some point next week. So this is sort of a 2.0 version of the game where it has new art, it has improved graphic design, so a lot of the text on the cards is clearer and streamlined so that it's more sensible. And they also did a bunch of like rules tweaks to make stuff flow better and to make decks like more cohesive and more thematic. And this got me to thinking of like just the iterative aspect of game design and, you know, sort of improving game mechanics and design elements within a specific game versus something like, you know, doing it over the course of a franchise, right? So, you know, things like, so this is different than, say, you know, the evolution of like Mario games from Super Mario Brothers to Super Mario Brothers 2 to Super Mario Brothers 3 to Super Mario World, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and something more like, you know, what we see nowadays where you see balance patches or content patches. You know, I don't maybe DLC, but also edition updates and errata for physical games, right? For analog games, if you will. So things, you know, not video games, but like board games, card games, like tabletop RPGs, or tabletop miniature games. And I just thought it's a really interesting thought of, and especially the distinction and how like digital games kind of do this better in that, from a consumer standpoint, in that usually, you know, for balance patches and stuff, you know, number one, those are free. And number two, like those would get put out at a regular pace so that bugs get fixed. The game becomes tighter, more polished. But also, like if there's stuff that is out of whack, that it kind of gets reined in. But, you know, can also mirror, say, physical print products. So to take an example of, you know, the biggest example, you know, I would have is Dungeons and Dragons, right? You know, we're in 5 editions of the game, not counting like all of the separate little weird mini offshoot editions, like 3.5, 4E Essentials, or second edition and like advanced Dungeons and Dragons second edition, and that sort of stuff. But like even that, you know, having those separations, and then you know, lately what they've been doing, what Wizards has been doing, I don't know if TSR did it, but is like putting out errata in books, so that like if you're a new player coming in and buying a new book, it will have the reprinting and have the new rules or updated rules printed. But if, you know, you're like me and you usually get in like when a game launches, that you now have like a couple pages of text now that you have to like go reference and be like, oh, okay, this is how it actually works. You know, that made me think of, it's very similar, and how like it, when a new edition launches, right? So the errata is almost like patch notes, right? Where, you know, it's updated, and like it's a little more inconvenient because it doesn't automatically update unless you use a service like D&D Beyond, where they do make those updates automatically. You know, when they launch a new edition, you know, in most cases, like not a whole lot changes, you know, unless it's like a big, huge edition shift, because like ever since Wizards moved to the D20 system, at its core, every, you know, third, 3.5, 4E and fifth. You know, I know there's a lot of people who are detractors and say like 4E isn't D&D. They're really all follow a lot of the same design philosophies. And all that, the only difference is, you know, the scaling of bonuses or the scaling of hit points. That's really the only difference. And a lot of the overall engine is the same, right? It just makes me think of, say, like Skyrim, where, you know, that's a digital example of, you know, they put out balance patches and, you know, updates and everything, but like, you know, they also kind of re-release the game every couple of years. And so it just made me think of a neat little parallel of like Skyrim as a digital version of D&D's release model. You know, and you could argue that like it's more akin to, you know, the franchise as a whole, where you have, you know, Morrowind, Oblivion, Skyrim. But I'd argue, you know, D&D is actually pretty closer to just like the myriad versions of Skyrim that we've experienced over the years. You know, complete with, because, you know, every time they re-release it, they include like more and more DLC or mods and things like that. So, but yeah, so I think it's interesting, just from a game design and gameplay standpoint, to, you know, as, you know, the years go on, you know, design sensibilities change, cultural sensibilities change, and you update your game to kind of reflect that, you know, or if it's you, release a complete game, and then it, as in the case of Stardew Valley, like you release a complete game, like a game that is fully enjoyable in its state, and people get their money's worth. And then you decide, you know what? I'm not done with this. Let's do more. Like, you know, this was successful. It's brought in income that allows me to make more stuff for it. I'm going to do it. And you just start releasing more content for it. You know, I think that's interesting. And it's something, you know, naturally, I do a lot of tweaking in my own projects to really like fine tune things. You know, especially since I often, you know, don't get a lot of feedback and kind of have to like, you know, do. You know, is that something that like that artists do and, you know, and a skill that we worked on when I was studying art in college, where it was, you know, when you get to a point and you're trying to figure out what else to do, you know, you take a step back, you know, and you go, you don't look at your work, you know, for 20 minutes, you know, maybe you take an hour break, you know, go out and go wander, you know, maybe you take a break for a meal, you know, and you just don't think about it, or you go look at something else and then you come back to it and then you see, okay, is there anything missing? Is there anything else that I can do? I think we're starting to especially see this a lot in tabletop RPGs. And I think a lot of that is culturally led, where many of these games, most notably D&D, or games that were inspired by D&D, are kind of having to contend with this, this pushback of, hey, these systems that you are built on have problems. And maybe we're overdue for fixing them. So why not? Let's take a look at it. And I think we're starting to see that, like, within an edition itself, which I think is very, very interesting. And I say that word gets overplayed a lot. I remember that was another thing that I remember from college, is like the word interesting being banned from critiques because it just got overused. And like, it doesn't really mean a whole lot in a lot of contexts. But I think it's very curious and intriguing, I would say, that of the number of changes we are getting to, you know, somewhat core systems, for like D&D specifically, within an edition without doing like a half edition step, or just a full on new edition. And I think that's good. Because that's hard to do with a print product. Like, it's much easier to do with a digital product, right? You know, where if there was a D&D video game that actually one-to-one mapped everything over, which you can't do because of the licensing involved. But if you were able to, like, one-to-one map it over, you know, it'd be much easier to introduce a lot of these changes. And updates in errata, and keep doing that. But yeah, ultimately this is stemming from, you know, the definitive edition, which, like, you know, played off as when the Kickstarter was run, that like, this is the same game. It's just kind of like a large scale balance update and improving the artwork and design of the game. You know, and I was like, hey, if it makes the game easier to play and more streamlined, I'm all for it. You know, it does things like fixing a notoriously difficult character to play, Absolute Zero, since he's like the only character in the base game that you can't do anything until you have specific cards in play. Whereas like every other character can like do something, even if it's like doing something in preparation, since his ability is he damages himself. Which, like, you know, when you get certain cards in play, like, allow you to combo that and do weird and interesting and wild effects, right? But at its core, like, unless you get those cards in play, like, it's just you just take damage and that's it. That's all that happens. And that's a problem because it's not fun, right? Like until you get those cards in play, and because of, you know, certain villains that you fight as a team. It is often very easy to lose those cards too. So, you know, they did things like tweak that, you know, make stuff more fun and faster a little bit. But, yeah, a lot of it was like improving the graphic design and the art because, I can't remember if they said like they actually had a graphic designer or not when they first designed the game. But I know the artist came back, you know, so the original artist was like, listen, I'm not happy with the artwork. I would like to do new artwork for this game and make it better because it's not great. So it's always like, you know, if it was the case where that was the only difference, I don't think I would have backed it. Cause like, while it's great that like, you know, an artist wants to redo the artwork and everything, like just a fresh coat of paint on it. You know, that wouldn't have been enough for me to warrant, you know, backing a whole new edition of the game and essentially having to start over. But with the other changes, you know, I think it'll be very interesting to also compare the two versions. And I think that's also where, so being able to compare, you know, a sort of before and after look at before changes were made and after changes were made to see, you know, how far a project comes, in terms of iterative design, is its strength, right? Is that, you know, and this often comes up a lot in like in development games or early access games, where, for better or worse, you know, you have a development patch that goes out to introduce a new feature. And, you know, sometimes it's great. Sometimes it completely changes how the game is played. You know, things like the new, when Phasmophobia introduced all the new ghost hunting tools, and a whole bunch of new ghosts, that dramatically changed how the game was played versus, you know, introducing like nightmare mode, you know, it introduces a new mode for players, but, also it broke a bunch of stuff. So it's kind of broken right now. So, you know, that's also a thing. I'm trying to think of any like updates that, you know, the weird unarmed strike sort of back and forth that seems to happen with D&D, and how like based on like a certain version of the errata that you have, like, you know, paladins can smite with unarmed strikes, but like after a certain point, like they then can't because of how unarmed strikes are defined, or, you know, natural weapons as, unarmed strikes for monks or things like that. And there's some very weird terminology that gets in there. And that's sort of like the ongoing debate for that. You know, there's a lot of folks who are, upset about, you know, the most recent errata that, removes alignment from all of the, sort of racial, option rules in D&D for making a character. And that's, you know, like that's essentially removing flavor text that generalizes an entire people. And you know, that I think gets overblown. So there's also times when, you know, a vocal minority will get really upset about a change that's made. So yeah, ultimately it was difficult to come up with a topic and write notes on a topic. This was sort of a last minute thing. But it was just, I think iterative game design is just a little is interesting. And intriguing to me. It fascinates me. And it was just inspired by this game that's arriving next week. That like I already have the base game and multiple expansions for, and so this is like starting over. So this is it's essentially the pain that I feel whenever D&D releases a new edition. And it's like, but I have all of these old books. Now what am I gonna do? Fun fact, when third converted over to fourth, I was like, great, I'm gonna get rid of all these books except for like my Dragonlance, campaign books. And then some friends ended up with all of my third edition books. But fourth edition, you know, I kept them all. Because I'm like, you know, it was kind of different enough and it had some stuff that didn't carry over to fifth, that I think was wrong. I'm going to say it right there that I think was wrong. And so I wish it had, converted over, but, yeah, I think ultimately, you know, I think game designers should be open to, like, once you put out a product, being able to come back maybe like a few years later and say, like, you know, as it turns out, you know, because like maybe a new game comes out that actually introduces some mechanics that like you were trying to figure out with your game and it does it better. And you're like, oh, you know, maybe we adjust things a little bit, you know, and try and work things another way, you know, and release like an update. Or you take the Magic the Gathering route and you don't tweak cards, apparently, and you just wait until they cycle out and you release different one, or you release different cards that deal with the problems. To be clear, I think that's a bad way to handle it. I would much rather they just like, cause I mean, you just say like, you just do a rata and just like reprint new versions of the cards. And then just say like, hey, if you have this version of the card, it's no longer tournament legal. Deal with it. but also, I don't know. That's a very specific topic where I think better design going into it also matters. Because there's a lot of CCG design philosophy that I don't agree with. Like that you have to make trash cards. Like, no, you don't have to make trash cards. You could just make a whole set of cards that are good. And then people have to decide. Like, because otherwise, then it's just, there's just trash for being trash. But for game designers to be open and willing to come back to a project that is complete, you know, at some point after release, whether it's months, years, maybe even a decade after the fact. You know, come back and like look at it and be like, does this game hold up? Are there things about this game that don't hold up, either design wise, cultural sensibility wise, you know, that maybe we need to go back and tweak some things. You know, and I say this as somebody that like went back and absolutely tore up a campaign setting to redo it. And, you know, and thought about like, what are things that could be done better? And I've been constantly iterating on Jamora for, you know, about 10 years now. and, you know, I've kind of just recently started to really like focus and put stuff down onto paper. So, yeah. I don't know. I think it's just, I think it's a design philosophy that is healthy to be able to go back and look at a project and say, like, what are there things that don't work about this? Can they be fixed? Can they be revised? And then to do it. And I would certainly hope that more developers and publishers are in the position that, Stardew Valley creator Eric Barone, Concerned Ape, are in, where they are able to put it out for free. You know? Because we don't see that a whole lot. So yeah. All right. So that is going to conclude is sort of a rambling deep dive on that. You know, if you have your own thoughts on iterative game design, you can reach me at, Sean@8-bitadventures.com. Let me know. Let me know if you have any opinions on it. I'd be happy to discuss it, in a more coherent manner. But so let's talk about Questlog, and I briefly mention why this has all sort of been slapdash and at the last minute. All right, so Questlog is where I set a goal to do before the next podcast, and do my best to try and meet that goal, talk about what I was supposed to do last week and get that stuff done. One of my big resolutions for last year was to get all of my Chapter One comics colored and ready for print, for self-publishing. It didn't happen. I'm about 12 comics short, or maybe 11 comics short. So I'm on 80. I just finished up 88, 8-Bit Adventures 1-88. So out of 100 comics, I have 89 to 100 left. So I guess that's 12 then. Yeah. So my goal for next week is to try and just color a comic. Normally I would have said, you know, yeah, goals like trying to get like four done. Yeah. However, I have been fairly sick, over the past week. My son has been diagnosed with COVID. So tested positive for COVID. So that has kind of threw a big wrench in everything, to be honest. Mostly the goal is to get better and to keep an eye on the kiddo, and make sure that he's okay. So it'll be doing my best to keep up with everything, but you know, if things have to fall by the wayside, they will. But rest assured, you know, nothing's going to completely go away. You know, it's just, sometimes having to set things aside to be a dad, to be a good dad. So, but the goal is, you know, ultimately the goal is to focus on getting better. And for that, everyone in the house to get better. But if there is time to do creative work, to try and color one comic, and hopefully I can get that done. So. All right. So ultimately that was why there wasn't a whole lot of preparation, unfortunately, for this week's episode, and why the deep dive was a little rambling and loosey-goosey. But if you haven't listened to last week's episode and you have seen Spider-Man No Way Home, go listen to it. Jamal's great. So just throw another shout out to that. Ultimately, that's going to wrap up this episode. Thank you all for joining me. If you want to see more content from 8-Bit Adventures, be sure to check out the still fairly fresh and new website over at 8-bitadventures.com. if you would like to help support that content. So namely, comics, artwork, there's still multiple podcasts out there. So there's still Berkshire Bites. There's still the Old Tales of Demora podcast. There's this one, you know, the streams, Stardew Sundays, all that stuff. You can become a patron over at patreon.com/8bitadventures. You can become a patron for 20% of the cost of a Twitch subscription. So $1 a month. And every little bit helps. I appreciate every single one of the patrons that I have. Thank you for your support. Thank you very much for keeping the lights on and keeping the projects going. So yeah, thank you to all of the patrons. Patreon.com/8bitadventures. And our opening theme is One Up by Professor Shy Guy. You can find his work over at ProfessorShyGuy.bandcamp.com. Links for all of these are going to be in the podcast notes, as well as in the chat if you are watching live on Twitch, or if you watch the VOD on Twitch, they will be in the chat. And we do have a Discord server if you want to go hang out and chat offline there. So the link's in chat. The link will also be in the show notes. I would say that is probably the best way to get updates on 8-Bit Adventures content. Outside of just like checking the website, just because social media relies on algorithms, Discord doesn't. And I prefer direct feeds. You know, I prefer chronological timelines over curated algorithms. So with that, that is going to wrap things up for this week's episode. So as always, have fun, happy gaming, and enjoy your Pie Cake.